Henri Pohl has been called the central poet of his generation and has won numerous awards, including a nomination for the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent poetry collection is called Blizzard. This is Henri Pohl. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Henri Pohl. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to meet you.
All right. So of all the people I've talked to people who have written poetry before, but they're writers who they write other things and poetry is a part of it. You're the first person I've talked to who is first and foremost a poet, and the job prospects are famously not great. So my first question is, at what point in your life did you decide to have the guts to say, all right, I'm going to make this my life?
Well, when I was an undergraduate, maybe around your age, I took a class with a writer in residence in Virginia, where I was from. And that was my introduction. And, you know, when you're 22 to 25, let's say, you know, you make decisions, you don't know it at the time, that affect the whole direction of your life. I'm now 64, so that's 40 years ago. And now I've suddenly published 10 books. As a young man, I came from a military family, and I was always looking for ways to be masculine in a slightly unorthodox way. And for me, this poetry was a way to be sociable. Actually, I was a shy young man, and when I picked up pen and put it to paper, it was a way to be conversational and to speak to the things that preoccupied me.
Did you find that it was easier to write down what it was you wanted to say as opposed to say it in the spur of the moment with other people and their eyes watching you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when you write something, you have more control too. You can almost go farther because you have more control in the passing moment with a room full of people.
Right. And you talked about how you make decisions at that age that affect the rest of your life. And at one point, I believe you said I don't know if it's at this point in your life, but as a young man, you wanted to be a visual artist. How long did you carry that forward for?
Well, I took art courses in college. I always liked doing things with my hands. Well, I still do. I take pictures compulsively, and I make collages. My father gave me a camera when I was, 9 or 10 years old, and I've taken pictures ever since. So, but I think I always knew I was an amateur artist. And for whatever reason, words were a better way for me. Was I had to say, I guess, than images.
That's interesting because and I think you mentioned this when you were talking about how you wanted at one point to be a visual artist, because, you know, there's a lot of self-portrait in visual art, for instance, and I believe you've referred to yourself in some ways as an autobiographical poet. Even if you're not a strict visual artist, I mean, do you think that early love has seeped into your poetry?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's an astute observation. Self-portraiture is a genre of the lyric poem. And, you know, one definition of the lyric poem is that it presents a snapshot of the self in a moment of being. in the same way, of course, that a sketch of your face in the mirror or a painting of oneself might accomplish that as well. You get a sort of x-ray of the soul in a lyric poem. And I've always been drawn to that more than I have been to telling a story, to plot and narrative. I'm not so drawn to those things. So you might say that a lyric poem is a visual representation in words of a moment in time.
And it's interesting because I think it's different today, but at some point in the history of poetry, an autobiographical poem, or certainly the work of confessional poets, would have been regarded less highly than, you know, some kind of a plotting poem, as you said, or a poem that was looking outward at external things. And yet the self-portrait in visual art has always been accepted. Well, why do you think, am I right in saying that first off? And if so, why do you think that is?
I don't know the answer to that. I think it's true that, I think there's a movement even in this moment we're living in that feels that a poem that is a representation of self is somehow less than a poem that a moment in which we're passing through, that the poet has a responsibility to more of a responsibility to do that than to give a snapshot of the self, say, though I myself would not embrace that position. I don't think it's good to, say you can do this and not that. A poem must do this and it cannot do that. I think one can do both things. And that's certainly what I tried to do in my book, Blizzard.
Right.
Which came out in September. There are more public poems, or you could call them political poems. Well, on this impeachment day, there are a couple of poems that speak directly to the president.
Yes, I want to talk about Blizzard, because there's a line in that I love, and it kind of it points a little bit to what you're talking about as the political nature of it, but it doesn't feel bound by politics. In other words, you have, I think it's the first poem in the book, where there's a bee that's just, in your words, staggered out of a flower, and you say something like, do you see me, a cisgender male, metabolizing life into language like nectar sipped up and regurgitated into gold? I love that line. So why, I guess I was kind of, it seemed, I don't know what my reaction was exactly, but I was surprised to see the phrase cisgender male in that very lyrical, observation. Was this something where, when you're writing this book, you said, okay, I want to infuse more politics into this, or I want to respond to this moment? How did that process happen?
Well, I'm always curious to use words that are not thought of as, poetic, or words I haven't read in a poem. I'm always curious to incorporate them. I like, different registers of speech in a poem. I mean, having the sort of conversational, chatty self, and then, more technical language as well, if possible. I like for the poem to sort of veer from one register to another. I've always been fascinated by bees as a metaphor for what poets do. in the way that they take something raw and turn it into, you know, gold, you might say. And so I've revisited, that's an image I have revisited in other poems. I write a whole lot about bees in my book, Orphic Paris, as well. But I don't know that it's all so much by design, you know, a calculation and design. I don't think I can claim that for myself. I wanted to begin with that movement, you might say, in the book, to make a pronouncement like that. But, you know, I think there's a, even after all these years of writing, there's an element of it that is completely mysterious, why we write what we write when we do write, and why we're silent or why we're prolific at certain times, and why we embrace certain subjects over others when we do. All that is sort of mysterious to me. I can't really chart that, even now after all this time. That's the part of it that makes it always interesting.
Right. And when you say you wanted to begin with that statement, when you say, is part of that sort of seeding or acknowledging this moment where there's a lot of attention to pay to the identity of the author of any given, you know, work of art, and
yes,
you wanted to acknowledge your own identity in this space.
Well, I guess I am, aren't I? I'm saying that I identify with my. I guess I was thinking that if others don't identify with their gender and announce that, why shouldn't I announce that I do identify with my gender? You know, I think that was a. Maybe that was a calculation of a sort. No, I didn't know of another poem where a poet did that. So I thought, well, why not?
Right.
But also I'm speaking to my parents in a way there too.
How so? The fact.
Well, I just, in speaking about no one is truly the owner of his own instincts, but controlling them, this is civilization. I thank my mother and father for this. After they died, there were replacements whose force upon my life I cannot measure. You know, I mean, the poem in a way is bringing them in as well. So
and
don't think of this poem as public or political. I wouldn't make that claim for it myself. So I'm interested that you do, I guess.
Well, I don't necessarily look at it as being a political poem, but the fact that you do announce that I'm like a cisgender male, in some ways it feels responsive to the literary politics of the moment. Am I wrong?
I don't know. I didn't think about that.
Maybe I'm just reading too much into it.
No, well, I think, you know, you're a different generation than I am, and maybe to you it does. To me, it's a statement of fact. You know, it's a statement of fact, a precise detail that isn't irrelevant, but it is embracing a sort of technicality of the moment that people are preoccupied with, I suppose. But I don't know, actually. But your response is interesting to me.
Okay. Do you feel, when you mentioned how there is a certain school of thought nowadays that these sort of autobiographical or self-reflective poems are somehow less important or maybe even self-indulgent in a moment of so many crises. Do you, as an artist, what is your perspective on that idea?
Well, I don't embrace that position at all. That seems to me very narrow agenda for art. if it has to speak to the president or the world or climate change, it's a wonderful thing that art can do that, but it's to its detriment if it can only do that, because people still experience love, hate, grief, desperation, wonder. You know, those are things that we seek out in art as viewers, as readers. You know, as we, you know, we learn what we feel. You know, we verify what is inside of us through reading and art. And that too is true for, you know, events in the world. But it just isn't only true for that. I feel, you know, as long as there are humans with souls, we'll seek out representations of what is there, you know, in our souls. And some of us will do that in books. Some of us will do that in visual art. Some of us will do that. It's a symphony, you know, or at a rock concert. Some of us do that in nature, but that art can only point to one thing, which is outward in the world. That seems to me a very narrow position, and a frightening one even.
How so?
Because we thirst for more. We hunger for more. We need more. I mean, there's a, you know, like a nurturing element to language and art, and we need nurturing of all sorts. Sometimes in a poem, the lens looks inward and gives a snapshot of the self in a moment of being, but sometimes it looks outward at the world. And there are, I suppose there are artists that only do one or only do another, but to make a declaration that a poem must do one or the other or fail is a, you know, that would be a tyrannical world.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word tyrannical, because I definitely agree with you that it's a frightening approach. And it kind of reminds me of how a lot of dictators at earlier points in their lives were failed or frustrated artists. Hitler's an obvious example, but Mao was a novelist. Stalin wrote, you know, like sappy love poetry. Saddam wrote romance novels. And you can, there's more examples, but it's a weird phenomenon where these people who are yes. obsessed with control turned yes. to art and then found, oh, wait a second, art is not providing me this ultimate power that I'm looking for. There's a sort of lack of control and a giving up that you have to do in art. So maybe I'll turn to something like politics.
Part of art, you know, containment of language is part of what gives the emotion pressure, say in a sonnet, or you were asking in your first communication with me about Twitter, the idea of word limitation.
Yes.
Clearly, you know, clearly the containment of a tweet, say, or the containment of a sonnet or of a quatrain is what gives it power. You know, I guess in part that's why I am less drawn to narrative poetry, because that tends to have more words in it. It tends to be longer lined. It tends to be more prolix. And, you know, therefore the kind of emotional energy measure is lower. Energy level is lower for me. I like extremis. I like intensity. I'm drawn to those. I'm drawn to intensity. But that's fascinating about all those, you know, evil people that they also have a, I don't know, a sentimental side, an emotional side.
Well, I think what I was kind of getting at, and this is a question also about how you experience the feeling of creativity when you're writing a poem, where on some level, an artist, when you have a blank page in front of you, you are, quote unquote, a dictator of that blank page. You can put whatever you want on it. But I think anyone, even if you've been a child at any point, you've experienced creativity where it doesn't feel like you're the one in control, where it's your ego plotting everything in front of you. It feels in some ways inspired or like a channeling. And that's a giving up of control, where a dictator would probably, someone that with that personality would not know how to do that or would not feel comfortable doing that. And so yes. Everything turns out sentimental. Do you approach poetry that way? Do you feel like you're fully in control despite these containment features?
No, I don't feel that way. I feel more and more out of control, actually. I feel that the words, this speaks to this mysterious part of the process that can't be explained. But sometimes I feel like I'm in a trance or something like that, even where the words are just coming because of some power or energy from the hand. And I just yield to it as an exercise and then go back later, of course, and revise or edit. But that's only in, a really good moment, a good time of composition. I feel myself when I'm first sitting down to write after a period of teaching, say when I've not been able to write, I do feel that control thing very strongly, and it's like I'm pushing myself or forcing something, and it's not a productive time. It's a painful time when sometimes I feel that about extremely formal poetry. There was a time in the 80s, 1980s, you probably weren't even born. You were a twinkle in your parents' eyes. But yes. That was an era of real formalism, when everyone of the moment was writing in these rhyming quatrains. And I used to feel about that was all about control, and that the, there was a pallid emotional content and high level of control. And that, I think, on the other hand, too much emotion, and too little control or no control is also a kind of death. Every writer has to work out his or her own equation, in relation to those things, one sort of being the more Apollonian model and one being the more Dionysian one, but they're somewhere in between, but some are at either end of the spectrum.
And you mentioned in there when you're teaching, you don't have as much time to write. There's a few questions I want to ask about that. First off, when you choose to write, is this a conscious decision where you say, okay, I'm going to carve out, this much time, or I need my time to be totally uninterrupted? Or can you snatch a few, half hours here and there to jot something down while you're teaching?
I don't do the latter, or rarely do the latter. When I teach, I'm sort of 100% into the teaching thing. I might do some reading, I might do some preparation for writing, but I haven't been most of my writing in the last years, say in the last 9 or 10 years, has been abroad. I carve out a time when I can go abroad for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and I just detach myself completely and go into a kind of bubble with a foreign language around me and, you know, a couple friends to see. But I leave the world of responsibility, teaching responsibilities, completely behind me, both literally and in time zone, different time zones, and et cetera. And that's where I've been able to do most of my writing. Just in the last week or two, I've been trying to, I'm in Boston, I'm speaking to you in Boston, where I have a home. I teach in Southern California, as you may know. I've been, you know, teaching remotely, and I thought, and now it's just hard. I feel like there are things to do in the household, or, you know, I mean, I can't imagine if I had children and a spouse to, you know, demanding me as well, demanding my time as well. I would be a terrible parent and a terrible spouse. So, you know, I've been able to keep poetry at the center of my life because, you know, because of the way I live. And I think, you know, I've benefited from that.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting now, I imagine, the remote teaching where you are, you're in your house, does the pressure ease off at all? Do you find yourself more capable of just or having more time to write now, or do you still want to carve out some uninterrupted time?
Well, if I could get on a plane and go to France tomorrow, I would do that.
Yeah, I would too.
I would definitely do that, because there's something about having a foreign language around me that insulates me. And in France, the foreign language is, my mother was French, so it's the language of my mother's first tongue. And that's probably a component of why I feel nurtured there. I don't know, reality feels very present here. And, you know, I think also we're just living at this extraordinary moment where, you know, I mean, I spent the morning listening to the radio broadcast of the impeachment hearing. So, you know, that's an extraordinary distraction as well. Whereas being abroad is that, of course, you see much more about what's happening in the world, which we get very little of on the news here. But I don't know. It's all so mysterious. It really is, Duncan. You know, I mean, I'd certainly like to think that I don't have to go to France to write poems. On the other hand, how wonderful that when I go to France, they come flowing out of my pen, you know. I feel a deep gratitude for that. So
when you make these trips, though, this might just be a difference in temperament. I would feel if I was going somewhere, I bought a plane ticket, rented a place, say in Japan, where you have written poetry before, and mm-hmm. had 2 weeks. And I'm saying, okay, well, the rest of the year I was teaching, I had other preoccupations, but now these 2 weeks, boy, a lot of poems better be coming. It would almost put a lot of pressure on me. Do you feel maybe the pressure helps. Do you feel there's pressure there?
Well, there is pressure. When I went to Japan, I mean, that was different. I went to Japan for 6 months to a year, and I didn't know a person, and I couldn't understand anything. I was isolated at the base of these mountains north of Kyoto. And so, you know, I actually saw, I mean, I didn't do anything for, I mean, I didn't do any writing for many, many weeks, but I read a lot. You know, for instance, I read all the novels of Kawabata, and, you know, I was sort of filling up my tank in a way And then eventually I figured out what I was. I did do a great deal there, but for, I think in a part, what travel is for me is new information. And I like new information. And there's a little bit of a feeling of stasis when I'm at home in my apartment and, you know, vacuuming and putting dishes away and stuff like that. Whereas when I'm on the road, I'm in between lives in a way. And that frees my mind. And it usually includes new information, new reading, new art, new friends, and all of those things, new things overheard in cafes, you know, new newspapers, all those things are sort of, I don't know, they're all kind of impetus for poetry, for me. I mean, I'm alone when I'm traveling, so if I was with someone else, I mean, once or twice I've traveled with someone else and we wake up in the morning and they, you know, they want to go do something.
Right.
And that feels to me like too much like being home where you have to get up and do something. I like just getting up and feeling a responsibility to nothing but to language and sitting down on the sofa, paper and just, you know, being, my mind is just completely free to begin in that way. That for me is the ideal situation for writing. I hate waking up and feeling like I'm disappointing someone because I don't want to go to breakfast with them or, you know, right. But on the other hand, that's life, isn't it? I mean, that's ridiculous to be confessing that.
No, but it makes sense. I mean, to have that sort of total ownership of your time seems.
I don't see anyone until about 3 p.m. when I'm in France. I usually set off and walk for an hour. I see my translator who's in her 90s, and, you know, I learned so much from her. And I walk there. And walking is a big part of my process, probably in a way that I haven't acknowledged, but.
Walking is, you know, famously a great way to stimulate ideas. A lot of famous, you know, Nietzsche would go on long walks throughout the day. I mean, do you ever?
For you is, why haven't you interviewed more poets? Why am I the first poet? I mean, that's, you put that on me like that's my responsibility in some way, but. Really, I listened last night to your Linda Gordon interview. She's a friend of mine. And I was really happy to hear her voice again. It made me so happy to hear her talk about Emily Dickinson. That was so unexpected and a thorough delight. And thank you for that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. She was great. I'm always down to talk about Emily Dickinson. You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know why I haven't. I guess maybe there was a part of me that thought that, you know, I didn't reach out to a lot of poets because I was like, maybe these people will not want to talk to me. I don't know. I don't know why.
How did you find your way to my work?
Well, I had seen you in bookshops before. It's kind of like...
You've seen me speak? No. My books?
I've seen your books. I haven't seen you speak yet. But at some point when COVID ends, and I mean, you'll be in Southern California, correct? Maybe.
Eventually. I mean, I thought it would be in March or April, but I'm not even sure if that's going to happen now. But
right.
But I have next.
Yeah, at some point, I would love to see you read your work, but it was your name just kept popping up, and eventually, I don't know, it was like seeing an advertisement for the same product again and again, you know, the power suggestion. I was like, okay, I should check this guy out. And then I don't know if it was the first time I had heard your name, but I had heard Harold Bloom also mention you as being, he said something like you're one of a central poet of your generation or something along those lines. I was like, okay, well, I should definitely check out whoever the central poet of a generation is. Your name just kept popping up basically. And that's a question I wanted to ask you too. Harold Bloom is now passed away. He's a famous critic, controversial to some people. What were your opinions on him?
Well, I have nothing negative to say about him. I know a lot of people do, or some people do. Harold Bloom wrote me a fan letter when I was in my 40s, and he was a complete stranger. He wasn't a teacher. I'm not sure that I'd really read much of him, but a letter was sent to me via my editor from him. And we corresponded for some years. I was, a youngish poet, middle-aged poet. It meant the world to me that he believed. Basically, all he said to me was that he believed in my work, and he thought what I was doing was important. And I had a lot of lean years in my 40s. It was applying for jobs every year, and into my 50s too, for that matter. And I didn't go the usual academic route. And he was like a, I don't know, like a uncle. Or something like a foreign uncle or something. Eventually we did meet, and I would go see him once or twice a year. I would take the train to New Haven and see, even when he was in steep decline. But to me, it's a miracle that he wrote to a stranger. This person of great stature wrote to a youngish poet and just encouraged them to keep going and didn't want anything, as far as I could tell. I suppose he wanted my friendship, which I happily gave him. And for me, it was just like a verification, like a stamp on my passport. I hope that kind of thing is still going on today.
There's a couple questions I want to ask you about that. For when you said it's a sort of a stamp on your passport, it seems like it's hard to give any sort of, and you've also won, a number of prizes that it would be too long to list, but these sort of outward acknowledgments of like, okay, you're on the right path, especially when you're younger, I would imagine, are very important. But how much do you, how much do you buy into them? I don't know how to phrase that, but do you know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, I think if you can't just take the praise seriously, right, and ignore all the criticism. Yeah. I suppose it's probably healthiest to just ignore all of it and just do your thing. When I was coming along, it seemed to me there was a great consensus about the poets of the generation ahead of me. And it seems to me there has never been the same kind of consensus about my own generation. I don't know why that is. These reputations of those ahead of me were really so large. They still are large. I'm speaking now of figures like Louise Gluck, say, or Frank Bidart, two of my favorite poets, you know, who are giant, really, in my imagination. Whereas people still argue about my own generation. So I guess that's an indirect way of saying that the prizes or the acknowledgments of my work mean a great deal to me. You know, I'm not part of the MFA culture. I teach undergraduates. It's a whole different kind of teaching than the kind of professional work, you know, professionalizing of poetry that takes place in an MFA program. I'm not criticizing that. I'm a product of, of Columbia University's MFA program. So I know its value and its limitations, but, you know, I've sort of gone my own way. As I said, I didn't really go the usual academic route. I spent a lot, I've lived abroad a great deal. So those verifications, those stamps on my passport, helped me to just keep going, doing things my way.
When I say, do you buy into it at all? I hope that didn't come across as me saying these tokens of admiration are somehow.
No. I know what you mean. I don't. No. I'm not. You know, I'm not defensive because of your question at all. It's a perfectly legitimate question.
But at the same time, you know, you read about other writers who did not receive that kind of acknowledgement, or they did and then it went away. Like I'm thinking of people like Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, and everyone said, hey, this book is terrible. And then he just went the rest of his life continuing to write.
And he was such a great writer. Well, none of that is really accountable. And look, though, he's a great writer. I may be forgotten in 10 years from now. We don't know anything about what lays ahead of Henri. Yeah, I can't speak to that really, except to say that Melville is a great novelist with wonderful poems too.
I suppose I bring him up as an example of someone who, and there are others who, you know, those a token of admiration would have meant a lot to him. And also, if you are that great of a writer, and you would have to be, as a prerequisite to that, you would have to be a good reader and a good evaluator of what's good. And if you're writing good stuff, on some level, you probably know it. And if no one's acknowledging it, there might be a voice in your head that goes, wait a second, like I'm pretty sure this is good, but I might be delusional. And that has got to be a really uncomfortable feeling.
Well, you have to believe in what you're doing to keep at it. And it is an aid to have others believe in you. I think of a poet like Elizabeth Bishop, you know, who's such a giant reputation now. But in the 70s, you know, she was so worried about her stature and her, you know, compared to someone like Robert Lowell, she was, you know, she had a much smaller reputation. And, you know, the history of their reputations has reversed itself now. And, you know, all of that is unknowable. And maybe some of it is just random. I mean, Bloom believed believed in what was good. He felt he could discern what was good and he believed in it and he praised it. It wasn't a random thing. Maybe reputation is more random, but you know, he wrote to me because he believed in my work. You know, my first, it was a book called The Look of Things that he first wrote to me. But
do you feel there are any poets, when you speak about the randomness of reputation, that you've picked up and you go, why is this person not more talked about?
Well, you know, I have felt that sometimes about when a poet wins the Nobel Prize, say. Like, I remember feeling that about Zimborska, Wisława Zimborska. I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong. But, you know, here was this whole body of work. She's a Polish poet that won, I don't know when she won the Nobel, 20 years ago. Now she's deceased. But, you know, it was so exciting to me think that, I mean, I'd seen individual poems around, but it was just so exciting to me that here was this whole lifetime of work that, because of translation, hadn't found its, you know, found its way earlier on into English, but, you know, suddenly was completely available. That to me is a great power to have, to call attention like that to a body of work and then to bring it into English. So I have felt that occasionally. There probably are poets that are not coming to mind right offhand that are my contemporaries, say, or older poets, maybe, that they say that it takes 10 years after you die, you know, for you to either be resurrected or erased.
Okay.
So we don't really know, you know, we don't really know.
It seems like what you're describing throughout this conversation, as you say, we don't really know, is a lot of uncertainty around the process of poetry, not knowing where it comes from, not knowing what's going to happen to it, not really knowing why, you know, maybe you pick the topics you pick. How do you live with that uncertainty?
Well, I don't know the answer to that either. I mean, because to choose to write poetry is to go against the whole current of the universe in a way, you know, which is capitalistic. When what I produce, you know, I make my living as a teacher. So, I mean, I don't really know. That's why return to the very beginning of this conversation was, how did I know? I mean, you know, I think because I was 21 or two, I wasn't obsessed with that. I mean, my parents were, you know, probably lower middle class, and then they became middle class, and they wanted me to go, you know, become a lawyer or go to work for the United States government or sell real estate or, you know, work for a bank. You know, those were the things I was brought up to do. And, you know, to write poetry, you know, not part of the program. So, I mean, I it gave me the will to do that. Probably I was drawn to the fact that it was against everything that, you know, I was sort of being programmed for, I felt. But it still exists. I mean, now I'm 64, as I say. So, I mean, it's just the way I am, where the way I live and the way I make my living. It's my identity now. It's just the normal thing. But and maybe it is a more normal thing even now than it was 40 years ago because of all the MFA programs that exist now. I don't know, but.
Well, it's. Also bringing it back to the beginning of the conversation, when you talked about how part of what made you seek out poetry was you used the word, it was a form of, you were trying to find a form of masculinity, which I wanted to ask at the time, but I'll ask now. When people think of poetry, I don't think the first word that comes to mind is masculinity. you know.
No, I know. I mean, my mother always said to me when I was a boy that I was too sensitive. I had to be, you know, tougher. And I guess the truth of it is that a large part of what makes a poet great is being alert to the sort of vibrations of the world. And so I feel my sensitivity ended up being a gift that his life, this thing that was criticized, you know, in this military family where I was raised, in fact, turned out to be a thing of power in my life. It's given my poetry, I think, intensity, and it's given, I don't know, it's given my being more meaning, you know? That's a happy result, but I could never have known that as a young man. You know, a young man in the South. I think young men today are, well, I used to think they were freer than I was, but after teaching in Ohio for some years, I saw all the same obstacles in terms of masculinity. The same obstacles exist today. I mean, the same kind of conservativeness and narrow definitions of gender, all of those things still exist. They may not exist, along the border states or 100 miles from the coast, but the further you go inland, those stereotypes still exist and are very oppressive. And part of what I do is push against all of that as a writer. And that's a power. That's a lot of power to have.
Well,
and I'm drawn to it, obviously.
And I think that doing what you're doing, which is going out of the coast or getting out of the academy, I think is so useful because it seems like in the coastal states, like at a place like USC, everyone pretty much is an atheist. And that is, saying God is dead is not only shocking or not shocking, but it has become trite, and it's almost as though, okay, let's move on. What is the next new big idea? And yet for a lot of the country, that is not true.
No, of course. That's very true. You can see that in these impeachment hearings, the way people speak about everyday events.
And one of the things that is interesting about how autobiographical your work is that in your early work, you were not initially out of the closet yet. So how did you resolve that tension?
Well, I suppose, I came out when I was 30. I mean, I came out to my parents when I was 30. That's pretty late, isn't it? I mean, nowadays, today, that would be like deeply, you know, you'd have to be deeply, what's the word? Not suppressed, but repressed to be that way. But I think... Well, there's like two different stories there. There's the story of my life and coming out, and then there's the story of the poetry and coming out in the poetry. One followed the other. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I don't have a simple answer to that.
Right.
It's just that one followed the story of my life. And but in a way, I as a young man, I felt that by writing about nature and writing about myth or writing about fairy tale, the human feeling that I could embrace without writing directly about homosexuality, say, or gay life, or queer life, as they say today. You know, our whole culture changed simultaneously too. I suppose that's a third narrative that goes to the story of my life and the story of my poems coming in. So I don't know, just eventually it happened. It happened slower than for most people, but I think in a way that turned out to be kind of a gift too, actually. Well, because by the time I was writing about them, I think I was abler to write about them than if I had been a young man. I mean, in terms of craft, than if when I was a young man. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just speculating, really. Right.
Well, it's interesting because you take different art forms. Like I heard a comedian once say that, and talking about coming out, would just say when they got on stage and they were in front of a room full of strangers, they felt that they could say whatever they wanted. And then eventually their parents saw their comedy and they said, all right, well, I guess you know now. And that process was reversed. Whereas part of the reason why I asked the question is when you were writing poetry while in the closet, did you ever think to yourself, like, wow, this is, there are things I want to write that, I for practical reasons, I couldn't? Or did your brain just not go in those directions? I mean, how did that work?
I don't remember thinking that. Well, when I was just starting off, I was much more a poet of sort of the orchestration of language. I loved, I loved like a whole full orchestra of language. I was writing at a much higher register, you know, rather than the more vernacular voice that I wrote in. And that sort of gives you, a veil to hide behind, or not to hide behind, but to speak through. And the story of my writing has been towards much more pellucidness or clarity or directness of statement. I mean, I think that's actually the story of almost every writer's life. I was sort of more drunk on language when I was a young poet. And I mean, but some of that had to do with that period of formalism in the 80s that I was talking about, when writing was quite different than it is today. I was in love with a poet like Hart Crane, who there's no question about the fact that the opera of language veiled, unsanctioned desire in his life. And I identified with that. And to me, it was a challenge, a wonderful sort of challenge to try and think of a way to write about something in a way that wasn't direct, a symbol that could give me the power to write about something private. That to me is a perfectly normal thing for a poet to do. So there was a kind of excitement actually about that as well. I wrote erotic poems, but they were very discreet or symbolic erotic poems.
Right. So it became, I like that phrase, not a mask to hide behind, but to speak through, because there's a lot of people in life who do that. I'm thinking of a lot of the irony and joking manner that I see of a lot of people on the right, where it's, you're quote unquote trolling people, but it's actually how you really feel too. That's just an observation I had when you said that. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's nothing. I don't have anything more to add.
Okay. So you mentioned the Twitter account. I couldn't find you on Instagram, but that seems like something, I don't know how familiar you are with the platform, but there are a lot of poets on Instagram who just post some of their poems. And I think that there are definitely poems of yours that are very Instagrammable.
There probably are some poems of mine on Instagram, but not posted by me.
Right.
I don't want to involve myself with another platform. I got onto Twitter because of the novelist Joyce Carol Oates, who just said that my emails were like tweets, you know, and that I should be on Twitter. And you know, now 5-8 years have gone by, I don't know. And I don't regret that. The thing I think that one is more text-based and the other is more image-based. Right. And one came after the other. You know, I'm not on Facebook, so I don't really want to be connected through the whole Facebook platform. more and more, I feel I don't want to be connected through the whole Facebook platform. You know, I'm relieved to just be on the Twitter. And what I do on Twitter is actually a little different than, I think, a little different than what other people do. I mean, I am sort of trying to put a lot of positive things into the world and take a lot of pictures and put images with text. And, you know, I am, but I got, I, you know, I do occasionally get sucked into the whole Trump vortex and,
right,
you know, become political, but being political is not really what I do there. I enjoy it. It's a way to be connected. You know, living abroad or living in confinement, it's a way to be connected to others out far away. And I do like that. I don't, you know, if anything makes me feel bad, I immediately suppress it.
Okay.
You know, on Twitter. I mean, I mute a whole lot of stuff, and I try not to do too much professional poetry stuff. But I like being connected to, I hear from people so far away, you know, in the Middle East or, you know, places I won't be able to get to for some time. And, you know, that's an exciting part of it for me.
You said the professional poetry, you try not to get too into that. And you had used that phrase before. What do you mean by professional poetry? Stuff that comes out of MFAs or?
Sort of the business of poetry and publishing and all of that, conferences and it's not really the writing part of it. But you know, it's not that my life doesn't include those things. And I like linking to poems of mine that I published. You know, readers can find their way to your work. I probably have found many readers through Twitter. And that makes me happy, you know. I mean,
The being uncomfortable with the professional nature, the professional side of poetry, is it's interesting, and I'm wondering if it's somehow tied up into your like Cormac McCarthy, for instance. I heard a story of his ex-wife saying that we would be sitting eating beans for dinner, and there would be a talk that he could give, a lecture that he could give down the road for like $500, and he wouldn't do it because not because he thought he was selling out or anything like that, but just because, you know, this is not something that engages my creative spirit in any way, therefore I don't want to do it. Do you identify with that feeling at all?
Oh, I don't know. I admire that. I mean, I admire that, actually. I don't know if I identify with it. I like the idea of giving a talk on beans. That's such an unusual thing to give a talk about. I give talks. I mean, I'm doing this interview with you now, right? Right. You're a total stranger. Why am I doing that? You know, I suppose I'm hoping to connect with some readers out in the world. That's part of what I do. It's also helpful for me to try and articulate answers to your questions. But, you know, a little of that goes a long ways. And I recognize that as well. You know, I have a handful of friends that are writers, and I'm grateful for their friendship. And that's, you know, I don't need to circulate too much more than that is my sense.
Okay. So, and I don't want to take up too much of your time here. So I only have a couple other questions I wanted to ask. And one relates to the Twitter thing. Do you feel that, I don't know if there's any great writing platforms out there online, but do you think, because in visual art, which you have an interest in, they've definitely incorporated technology on some level, and not just commenting on it, but using it as a material. And likewise with music, I mean, every piece of music now is run through a computer. But it seems like the literary arts, to the extent that there have been experiments with using technology to change the form or create a new medium, it feels very clunky, at least to me. Do you think that there are any new creative opportunities out there for writers with the digital era?
I don't know. You know, I still read books of poetry. I rarely read poetry on the net. I know that's not true for younger people who read it on their telephones. I fear the scroll button. I fear the scroll button has made people prolix, and it has made poetry maybe too accessible in a way. There's a sort of text creep into poetry, which is, you know, it can be original somewhat, but a little of it goes a long ways for me. As I've said, I like different textures of language in poetry. I don't want it all to be sort of that, you know, text talk, you might call it, ultra talk, or I don't know what to call it. And, you know, I think there's something to the 8.5 by 11 page containing a poem. I mean, there are very few poems that really need to go over a page and a half, lyric poems, almost none. So I think the screen and the scroll button encourage a violation of that. Well, I fear that. Let me say that. That's my only thought about it.
Fair enough. I feel like at some point there's got to be, I don't know, maybe it would work better in a prose, in a narrative, but it feels like at some point there's got to be, if the printing press allowed the novel to be created, perhaps there's something similar with the internet. I don't know. But I was just curious your thoughts on that.
You know, when I'm in France, I don't have a printer, and I do write poetry. I mean, after I've written it in a pad of paper, I put it on, I type, you know, a document, And then I just revise the document again and again, and then every revision erases the one that came before. When I'm here, I print things out and I have copies and I'm happy to look back at other earlier versions. But when I'm there, everything vanishes, you know. And I don't know that one way is better than the other in that sense. But I do start with a pad of paper and then move to this. So the pad of paper kind of in the original shaping impulse is still containing it, you might say. But I lose all the drafts. I mean, I know I could create, you know, save documents and do all, but I have no interest in doing all that, you know.
Fair enough. That's the last question I wanted to ask you is, what advice do you have to young poets?
Oh, well, I think listening to others is, I mean, people that you respect has been very helpful to me. But also to trust your own voice. Be wary of the fashion of the moment, which, you know, the great stone truck of time will crush. To always try and say something true. Don't forget about feeling while you're doing some sort of acrobat of language. Always come back to feeling. There's no good poem without feeling.
I think that's a good note to end it on. Henri, thank you so much for your time. And after this, I will definitely reach out to more poets because I really enjoyed our conversation.
Likewise. Thank you.
Great.
Let me know when you...
When I post, yes, I will send you a link.
Very good. Take care of yourself.
Alrighty. Take care. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you to Henri Cole, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.